Chapter 16. Tokyo. The internet is fundamentally American, but I had to leave America to fully understand what that meant. The World Wide Web might have been invented in Geneva at the CERN Research Laboratory in 1989, but the ways by which the web is accessed are as American as baseball, which gives the American intelligence community the home field advantage. The cables and satellites, the servers and towers, so much of the infrastructure of the internet is under U.S. control that over 90% of the world's internet traffic passes through technologies developed, owned, and/or operated by the American government and American businesses, most of which are physically located on American territory. Countries that traditionally worry about such advantages, like China and Russia, have attempted to make alternative systems, such as the Great Firewall, or the state-sponsored censored search engines, or the nationalized satellite constellations that provide selective GPS. But America remains the hegemon, the keeper of the master switches that can turn almost anyone on and off at will. It's not just the internet's infrastructure that I'm defining as fundamentally American. It's the computer software, Microsoft, Google, Oracle, and the hardware, HP, Apple, Dell, too. It's everything from the chips, Intel, Qualcomm, to the routers and modems, Cisco, Juniper, to the web services and platforms that provide email and social networking and cloud storage, Google, Facebook, and the most structurally important but invisible, Amazon, which provides cloud services to the U.S. government along with half the internet. Though some of these companies might manufacture their devices in, say, China, the companies themselves are American and are subject to American law. The problem is, they're also subject to classified American policies that pervert law and permit the U.S. government to surveil virtually every man, woman, and child who has ever touched a computer or picked up a phone. Given the American nature of the planet's communications infrastructure, it should have been obvious that the U.S. government would engage in this type of mass surveillance. It should have been especially obvious to me. Yet it wasn't. Mostly because the government kept insisting that it did nothing of the sort, and generally disclaimed the practice in courts and in the media in a manner so adamant that the few remaining skeptics who accused it of lying were treated like wild-haired conspiracy junkies. Their suspicions about secret NSA programs seemed hardly different from paranoid delusions involving alien messages being beamed to the radios in our teeth. We, me, you, all of us, were too trusting. But what makes this all the more personally painful for me was that the last time I'd made this mistake, I'd supported the invasion of Iraq and joined the army. When I arrived in the IC, I felt sure that I'd never be fooled again, especially given my top secret clearance. Surely, that had to account for some degree of transparency. After all, why would the government keep secrets from its secret keepers? This is all to say that the obvious didn't even become the thinkable for me until sometime after I moved to Japan in 2009 to work for the NSA, America's premier signals intelligence agency. It was a dream job, not only because it was with the most advanced intelligence agency on the planet, but also because it was based in Japan, a place that had always fascinated Lindsay and me. It felt like a country from the future. Though mine was officially a contractor position, its responsibilities and especially its location were more than enough to lure me. It's ironic that only by going private again was I put in a position to understand what my government was doing. On paper, I was an employee of Perot Systems, a company founded by that diminutive, hyperactive Texan who founded the Reform Party and twice ran for the presidency. But almost immediately after my arrival in Japan, Perot Systems was acquired by Dell. So, on paper, I became an employee of Dell. As in the CIA, this contractor status was all just formality and cover, and I only ever worked in an NSA facility. The NSA's Pacific Technical Center, PTC, occupied one half of a building inside the enormous Yokota Air Base. As the headquarters of U.S. Forces Japan, the base was surrounded by high walls, steel gates, and guarded checkpoints. Yokota and the PTC were just a short bike ride from where Lindsay and I got an apartment in Fusa, a city at the western edge of Tokyo's vast metropolitan spread. The PTC handled the NSA's infrastructure for the entire Pacific and provided support for the agency's spoke sites in nearby countries. Most of these were focused on managing the secret relationships that let the NSA cover the Pacific Rim with spy gear, as long as the agency promised to share some of the intelligence it gleaned with regional governments, so long as their citizens didn't find out what the agency was doing. Communications interception was the major part of the mission. The PTC would amass cuts from captured signals and push them back across the ocean to Hawaii, and Hawaii, in turn, would push them back to the continental United States. My official job title was systems analyst, with responsibility for maintaining the local NSA systems, though much of my initial work was that of a systems administrator, helping to connect the NSA's systems architecture with the CIA's. Because I was the only one in the region who knew the CIA's architecture, I'd also travel out to U.S. embassies, like the one I'd left in Geneva, establishing and maintaining the links that enabled the agencies to share intelligence in ways that hadn't previously been possible. This was the first time in my life that I truly realized the power of being the only one in a room with a sense not just of how one system functioned internally, but how it functioned together with multiple systems, or didn't. Later, as the chiefs of the PTC came to recognize that I had a knack for hacking together solutions to their problems, I was given enough of a leash to propose projects of my own. Two things about the NSA stunned me right off the bat. How technologically sophisticated it was compared with the CIA, and how much less vigilant it was about security in its every iteration, from the compartmentalization of information to data encryption. In Geneva, we'd had to haul the hard drives out of the computer every night and lock them up in a safe. And what's more, those drives were encrypted. The NSA, by contrast, hardly bothered to encrypt anything. In fact, it was rather disconcerting to find out that the NSA was so far ahead of the game in terms of cyber intelligence, yet so far behind it in terms of cybersecurity, including the most basic, disaster recovery, or backup. Each of the NSA's spoke sites collected its own intel, stored the intel on its own local servers, and because of bandwidth restrictions, limitations on the amount of data that could be transmitted at speed, often didn't send copies back to the main servers at NSA headquarters. This meant that if any data were destroyed at a particular site, the intelligence that the agency had worked hard to collect could be lost. My chiefs at the PTC understood the risks the agency was taking by not keeping copies of many of its files, so they tasked me with engineering a solution and pitching it to the decision makers at headquarters. The result was a backup and storage system that would act as a shadow NSA, a complete, automated, and constantly updating copy of all the agency's most important material, which would allow the agency to reboot and be up and running again with all its archives intact, even if Fort Meade were reduced to smoldering rubble. The major problem with creating a global disaster recovery system, or really with creating any type of backup system that involves a truly staggering number of computers, is dealing with duplicated data. In plain terms, you have to handle situations in which, say, 1,000 computers all have copies of the same single file. You have to make sure you're not backing up that same file 1,000 times, because that would require 1,000 times the amount of bandwidth and storage space. It was this wasteful duplication in particular that was preventing the agency's spoke sites from transmitting daily backups of their records to Fort Meade, the connection would be clogged with 1,000 copies of the same file containing the same intercepted phone call, 999 of which the agency did not need. The way to avoid this was deduplication, a method to evaluate the uniqueness of data. The system that I designed would constantly scan the files at every facility at which the NSA stored records, testing each block of data down to the slightest fragment of a file to find out whether or not it was unique. Only if the agency lacked a copy of it back home would the data be automatically queued for transmission, reducing the volume that flowed over the agency's trans-Pacific fiber optic connection from a waterfall to a trickle. The combination of deduplication and constant improvements in storage technology allowed the agency to store intelligence data for progressively longer periods of time. Just over the course of my career, the agency's goal went from being able to store intelligence for days to weeks to months to 5 years or more after its collection. By the time of this book's publication, the agency might already be able to store it for decades. The NSA's conventional wisdom was that there was no point in collecting anything unless they could store it until it was useful, and there was no way to predict when exactly that would be. This rationalization was fuel for the agency's ultimate dream, which is permanency, to store all of the files it has ever collected and produced for perpetuity, and so create a perfect memory, the permanent record. The NSA has a whole protocol you're supposed to follow when you give a program a code name. It's basically an I Ching-like stochastic procedure that randomly picks words from two columns. An internal website throws imaginary dice to pick one name from column A and throws again to pick one name from column B. This is how you end up with names that don't mean anything, like Fox Acid and Egotistical Giraffe. The point of a code name is that it's not supposed to refer to what the program does. As has been reported, Fox Acid was the code name for NSA servers that host malware versions of familiar websites. Egotistical Giraffe was an NSA program intended to exploit a vulnerability in certain web browsers running Tor, since they couldn't break Tor itself. But agents at the NSA were so confident of their power and the agency's absolute invulnerability that they rarely complied with the regulations. In short, they'd cheat and redo their dice throws until they got the name combination they wanted, whatever they thought was cool, traffic thief, the VPN attack orchestrator. I swear I never did that when I went about finding a name for my backup system. I swear that I just rolled the bones and came up with Epic Shelter. Later, once the agency adopted the system, they renamed it something like the Storage Modernization Plan or Storage Modernization Program. Within 2 years of the invention of Epic Shelter, a variant had been implemented and was in standard use under yet another name. The material that I disseminated to journalists in 2013 documented such an array of abuses by the NSA, accomplished through such a diversity of technological capabilities, that no one agent in the daily discharge of their responsibilities was ever in the position to know about all of them, not even a systems administrator. To find out about even a fraction of the malfeasance, you had to go searching. And to go searching, you had to know that it existed. It was something as banal as a conference that first clued me in to that existence, sparking my initial suspicion about the full scope of what the NSA was perpetrating. In the midst of my Epic Shelter work, the PTC hosted a conference on China sponsored by the Joint Counterintelligence Training Academy, JCITA, for the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, an agency connected to the Department of Defense that specializes in spying on foreign militaries and foreign military-related matters. This conference featured briefings given by experts from all the intelligence components, the NSA, CIA, FBI, and military, about how the Chinese intelligence services were targeting the IC and what the IC could do to cause them trouble. Though China certainly interested me, this wasn't the kind of work I would ordinarily have been involved in, so I didn't pay the conference much mind until it was announced that the only technology briefer was unable to attend at the last minute. I'm not sure what the reason was for that absence, maybe flu, maybe kismet, but the course chair for the conference asked if there was anyone at the PTC who might be able to step in as a replacement, since it was too late to reschedule. One of the chiefs mentioned my name, and when I was asked if I wanted to give it a shot, I said yes. I liked my boss, and I wanted to help him out. Also, I was curious, and relished the opportunity to do something that wasn't about data deduplication for a change. My boss was thrilled. Then he told me the catch. The briefing was the next day. I called Lindsay and told her I wouldn't be home. I was going to be up all night preparing the presentation, whose nominal topic was the intersection between a very old discipline, counterintelligence, and a very new discipline, cyber intelligence, coming together to try to exploit and thwart the adversary's attempts to use the internet to gather surveillance. I started pulling everything off the NSA network and off the CIA network, to which I still had access, trying to read every top-secret report I could find about what the Chinese were doing online. Specifically, I read up on so-called intrusion sets, which are bundles of data about particular types of attacks, tools, and targets. IC analysts used these intrusion sets to identify specific Chinese military cyber intelligence or hacking groups, in the same way that detectives might try to identify a suspect responsible for a string of burglaries by a common set of characteristics or modus operandi. The point of my researching this widely dispersed material was to do more than merely report on how China was hacking us, however. My primary task was to provide a summary of the IC's assessment of China's ability to electronically track American officers and assets operating in the region. Everyone knows, or thinks they know, about the draconian internet measures of the Chinese government. And some people know, or think they know, the gravamen of the disclosures I gave to journalists in 2013 about my own government's capabilities. But listen, it's one thing to casually say in a science fiction dystopic type of way that a government can theoretically see and hear everything that all of its citizens are doing. It's a very different thing for a government to actually try to implement such a system. What a science fiction writer can describe in a sentence might take the concerted work of thousands of technologists and millions of dollars of equipment. To read the technical details of China's surveillance of private communications, to read a complete and accurate accounting of the mechanisms and machinery required for the constant collection, storage, and analysis of the billions of daily telephone and internet communications of over a billion people, was utterly mind-boggling. At first, I was so impressed by the system's sheer achievement and audacity that I almost forgot to be appalled by its totalitarian controls. After all, China's government was an explicitly anti-democratic single-party state. NSA agents, even more than most Americans, just took it for granted that the place was an authoritarian hellhole. Chinese civil liberties weren't my department. There wasn't anything I could do about them. I was sure of it, for the good guys. And that made me a good guy, too. But there were certain aspects of what I was reading that disturbed me. I was reminded of what is perhaps the fundamental rule of technological progress. If something can be done, it probably will be done, and possibly already has been. There was simply no way for America to have so much information about what the Chinese were doing without having done some of the very same things itself. And I had the sneaking sense that while I was looking through all this China material, that I was looking at a mirror and seeing a reflection of America. What China was doing publicly to its own citizens, America might be, could be, doing secretly to the world. And although you should hate me for it, I have to say that at the time I tamped down my unease. Indeed, I did my best to ignore it. The distinctions were still fairly clear to me. China's Great Firewall was domestically censorious and repressive, intended to keep its citizens in and America out in the most chilling and demonstrative way, while the American systems were invisible and purely defensive. As I then understood U.S. surveillance, anyone in the world could come in through America's internet infrastructure and access whatever content they pleased, unblocked and unfiltered, or at least only blocked and filtered by their home countries and American businesses, which are presumptively not under U.S. government control. It was only those who'd been expressly targeted for visiting, for example, jihadist bombing sites or malware marketplaces, who would find themselves tracked and scrutinized. Understood this way, the U.S. surveillance model was perfectly okay with me. It was more than okay, actually. I fully supported defensive and targeted surveillance. A firewall that didn't keep anybody out, but just burned the guilty. But in the sleepless days after that sleepless night, some dim suspicion still stirred in my mind. Long after I gave my China briefing, I couldn't help but keep digging around. At the start of my employment with the NSA in 2009, I was only slightly more knowledgeable about its practices than the rest of the world. From journalists' reports, I was aware of the agency's myriad surveillance initiatives authorized by President George W. Bush in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. In particular, I knew about its most publicly contested initiative, the warrantless wiretapping component of the President's Surveillance Program, PSP, which had been disclosed by the New York Times in 2005, thanks to the courage of a few NSA and Department of Justice whistleblowers. Officially speaking, the PSP was an executive order, essentially a set of instructions set down by the American president that the government has to consider the equal of public law, even if they're just scribbled secretly on a napkin. The PSP empowered the NSA to collect telephone and internet communications between the United States and abroad. Notably, the PSP allowed the NSA to do this without having to obtain a special warrant from a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a secret federal court established in 1978 to oversee IC requests for surveillance warrants after the agencies were caught domestically spying on the anti-Vietnam War and civil rights movements. Following the outcry that attended the Times revelations and American Civil Liberties Union challenges to the constitutionality of the PSP in non-secret regular courts, the Bush administration claimed to have let the program expire in 2007. But the expiration turned out to be a farce. Congress spent the last 2 years of the Bush administration passing legislation that retroactively legalized the PSP. It also retroactively immunized from prosecution the telecoms and internet service providers that had participated in it. This legislation, the Protect America Act of 2007 and the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, employed intentionally misleading language to reassure U.S. citizens that their communications were not being explicitly targeted, even as it effectively extended the PSP's remit. In addition to collecting inbound communications coming from foreign countries, the NSA now also had policy approval for the warrantless collection of outbound telephone and internet communications originating within American borders. That, at least, was the picture I got after reading the government's own summary of the situation, which was issued to the public in an unclassified version in July 2009, the very same summer that I spent delving into Chinese cyber capabilities. This summary, which bore the nondescript title of Unclassified Report on the President's Surveillance Program, was compiled by the offices of the Inspector Generals of five agencies: Department of Defense, Department of Justice, CIA, NSA, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. and was offered to the public in lieu of a full congressional investigation of Bush-era NSA overreach. The fact that President Obama, once in office, refused to call for a full congressional investigation was the first sign, to me at least, that the new president, for whom Lindsey had enthusiastically campaigned, intended to move forward without a proper reckoning with the past. As his administration rebranded and recertified PSP-related programs, Lindsey's hope in him, as well as my own, would prove more and more misplaced. While the unclassified report was mostly just old news, I found it informative in a few respects. I remember being immediately struck by its curious, "they do protest too much" tone, along with more than a few twists of logic and language that didn't compute. As the report laid out its legal arguments in support of various agency programs, rarely named and almost never described, I couldn't help but notice the fact that hardly any of the executive branch officials who had actually authorized these programs had agreed to be interviewed by the inspector generals. From Vice President Dick Cheney and Attorney General John Ashcroft to DOJ lawyers David Addington and John Yoo, nearly every major player had refused to cooperate with the very offices responsible for holding the IC accountable. And the IGs couldn't compel them to cooperate, because this wasn't a formal investigation involving testimony. It was hard for me to interpret their absence from the record as anything other than an admission of malfeasance. Another aspect of the report that threw me was its repeated obscure references to other intelligence activities, for which no viable legal rationale or no legal basis could be found beyond President Bush's claim of executive powers during wartime, a wartime that had no end in sight. Of course, these references gave no description whatsoever of what these activities might actually be, but the process of deduction pointed to warrantless domestic surveillance, as it was pretty much the only intelligence activity not provided for under the various legal frameworks that appeared subsequent to the PSP. As I read on, I wasn't sure that anything disclosed in the report completely justified the legal machinations involved, let alone the threats by then Deputy Attorney General James Comey and then FBI Director Robert Mueller to resign if certain aspects of the PSP were reauthorized. Nor did I notice anything that fully explained the risks taken by so many fellow agency members, agents much senior to me with decades of experience, and DOJ personnel, to contact the press and express their misgivings about how aspects of the PSP were being abused. If they were putting their careers, their families, and their lives on the line, it had to be over something graver than the warrantless wiretapping that had already made headlines. That suspicion sent me searching for the classified version of the report, and it was not in the least dispelled by the fact that such a version appeared not to exist. I didn't understand. If the classified version was merely a record of the sins of the past, it should have been easily accessible. But it was nowhere to be found. I wondered whether I was looking in the wrong places. After a while of ranging fairly widely and still finding nothing, though, I decided to drop the issue. Life took over, and I had work to do. When you get asked to give recommendations on how to keep IC agents and assets from being uncovered and executed by the Chinese Ministry of State Security, it's hard to remember what you were Googling the week before. It was only later, long after I'd forgotten about the missing IG report, that the classified version came skimming across my desktop as if in proof of that old maxim that the best way to find something is to stop looking for it. Once the classified version turned up, I realized why I hadn't had any luck finding it previously. It couldn't be seen, not even by the heads of agencies. It was filed in an Exceptionally Controlled Information, ECI, compartment, an extremely rare classification used only to make sure that something would remain hidden even from those holding top secret clearance. Because of my position, I was familiar with most of the ECIs at the NSA, but not this one. The report's full classification designation was top secret/STLW/HCS/COMINT/ORCON/NOFORN, which translates to pretty much only a few dozen people in the world are allowed to read this. I was most definitely not one of them. The report came to my attention by mistake. Someone in the NSA IG's office had left a draft copy on a system that I, as a sysadmin, had access to. Its caveat of STLW, which I didn't recognize, turned out to be what's called a dirty word on my system, a label signifying a document that wasn't supposed to be stored on lower security drives. These drives were being constantly checked for any newly appearing dirty words, and the moment one was found, I was alerted so that I could decide how best to scrub the document from the system. But before I did, I'd have to examine the offending file myself just to confirm that the dirty word search hadn't flagged anything accidentally. Usually I'd just take the briefest glance at the thing, but this time, as soon as I opened the document and read the title, I knew I'd be reading it all the way through. Here was everything that was missing from the unclassified version. Here was everything that the journalism I'd read had lacked, and that the court proceedings I'd followed had been denied. A complete accounting of the NSA's most secret surveillance programs, and the agency directives and Department of Justice policies that had been used to subvert American law and contravene the U.S. Constitution. After reading the thing, I could understand why no IC employee had ever leaked it to journalists, and no judge would be able to force the government to produce it in open court. The document was so deeply classified that anybody who had access to it who wasn't a sysadmin would be immediately identifiable. And the activities it outlined were so deeply criminal that no government would ever allow it to be released unredacted. One issue jumped out at me immediately. It was clear that the unclassified version I was already familiar with wasn't a redaction of the classified version, as would usually be the practice. Rather, it was a wholly different document, which the classified version immediately exposed as an outright and carefully concocted lie. The duplicity was stupefying, especially given that I'd just dedicated months of my time to deduplicating files. Most of the time, when you're dealing with two versions of the same document, the differences between them are trivial, a few commas here, a few words there. But the only thing these two particular reports had in common was their title. Whereas the unclassified version merely made reference to the NSA being ordered to intensify its intelligence-gathering practices following 9/11, the classified version laid out the nature and scale of that intensification. The NSA's historic brief had been fundamentally altered from targeted collection of communications to bulk collection, which is the agency's euphemism for mass surveillance. And whereas the unclassified version obfuscated this shift, advocating for expanded surveillance by scaring the public with the specter of terror, the classified version made this shift explicit, justifying it as the legitimate corollary of expanded technological capability. The NSA IG's portion of the classified report outlined what it called a collection gap, noting that existing surveillance legislation, particularly the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, dated from 1978, a time when most communications signals traveled via radio or telephone lines, rather than fiber optic cables and satellites. In essence, the agency was arguing that the speed and volume of contemporary communication had outpaced and outgrown American law. No court, not even a secret court, could issue enough individually targeted warrants fast enough to keep up, and that a truly global world required a truly global intelligence agency. All of this pointed, in the NSA's logic, to the necessity of the bulk collection of internet communications. The code name for this bulk collection initiative was indicated in the very dirty word that got it flagged on my system. STLW, an abbreviation of Stellar Wind. This turned out to be the single major component of the PSP that had continued and even grown in secret after the rest of the program had been made public in the press. Stellar Wind was the classified report's deepest secret. It was, in fact, the NSA's deepest secret, and the one that the report's sensitive status had been designed to protect. The program's very existence was an indication that the agency's mission had been transformed, from using technology to defend America to using technology to control it by redefining citizens' private internet communications as potential signals intelligence. Such fraudulent redefinitions ran throughout the report, but perhaps the most fundamental and transparently desperate involved the government's vocabulary. Stellar Wind had been collecting communications since the PSP's inception in 2001. But in 2004, when Justice Department officials balked at the continuation of the initiative, the Bush administration attempted to legitimize it ex post facto by changing the meanings of basic English words, such as acquire and obtain. According to the report, it was the government's position that the NSA could collect whatever communication records it wanted to without having to get a warrant, because it could only be said to have acquired or obtained them in the legal sense if and when the agency searched for and retrieved them from its database. This lexical sophistry was particularly galling to me, as I was well aware that the agency's goal was to be able to retain as much data as it could for as long as it could, for perpetuity. If communications records would only be considered definitively obtained once they were used, they could remain unobtained but collected in storage forever, raw data awaiting its future manipulation. By redefining the terms acquire and obtain, from describing the act of data being entered into a database to describing the act of a person, or more likely an algorithm, querying that database and getting a hit or return at any conceivable point in the future, the U.S. government was developing the capacity of an eternal law enforcement agency. At any time, the government could dig through the past communications of anyone it wanted to victimize in search of a crime. And everybody's communications contained evidence of something. At any point, for all perpetuity, any new administration, any future rogue head of the NSA, could just show up to work and as easily as flicking a switch, instantly track everybody with a phone or a computer, know who they were, where they were, and what they were doing with whom, and what they had ever done in the past. The term mass surveillance is more clear to me, and I think to most people, than the government's preferred bulk collection, which to my mind threatens to give a falsely fuzzy impression of the agency's work. Bulk collection makes it sound like a particularly busy post office or sanitation department, as opposed to an historic effort to achieve total access to and clandestinely take possession of the records of all digital communications in existence. But even once a common ground of terminology is established, misperceptions can still abound. Most people, even today, tend to think of mass surveillance in terms of content, the actual words they use when they make a phone call or write an email. When they find out that the government actually cares comparatively little about that content, they tend to care comparatively little about government surveillance. The relief is understandable to a degree due to what each of us must regard as the uniquely revealing and intimate nature of our communications, the sound of our voice, almost as personal as a thumbprint, the inimitable facial expression we put on in a selfie sent by text. The unfortunate truth, however, is that the content of our communications is rarely as revealing as its other elements, the unwritten, unspoken information that can expose the broader context and patterns of behavior. The NSA calls this metadata. The term's prefix, meta, which traditionally is translated as above or beyond, is here used in the sense of about. Metadata is data about data. It is, more accurately, data that is made by data, a cluster of tags and markers that allow data to be useful. The most direct way of thinking about metadata, however, is as activity data. All the records of all the things you do on your devices and all the things your devices do on their own. Take a phone call, for example. Its metadata might include the date and time of the call's duration, the number from which the call was made, the number being called, and their locations. An email's metadata might include information about what type of computer it was generated on, where and when, who the computer belonged to, who sent the email, who received it, where and when it was sent and received, and who, if anyone besides the sender and recipient, accessed it, and where and when. Metadata can tell your surveillance the address you slept at last night and what time you got up this morning. It reveals every place you visited during your day and how long you spent there. It shows who you were in touch with and who was in touch with you. It's this fact that obliterates any government claim that metadata is somehow not a direct window into the substance of a communication. With the dizzying volume of digital communications in the world, there is simply no way that every phone call could be listened to or email could be read. Even if it were feasible, however, it still wouldn't be useful. And anyway, metadata makes this unnecessary by winnowing the field. That's why it's best to regard metadata not as some benign abstraction, but as the very essence of content. It is precisely the first line of information that the party surveilling you requires. There's another thing, too. Content is usually defined as something that you knowingly produce. You know what you're saying during a phone call or what you're writing in an email. But you have hardly any control over the metadata you produce because it is generated automatically. Just as it's collected, stored, and analyzed by machine, it's made by machine too, without your participation or even consent. Your devices are constantly communicating for you whether you want them to or not. And unlike the humans you communicate with of your own volition, your devices don't withhold private information or use code words in an attempt to be discreet. They merely ping the nearest cell phone towers with signals that never lie. One major irony here is that law, which always lags behind technological innovation by at least a generation, gives substantially more protections to a communication's content than to its metadata. And yet, intelligence agencies are far more interested in the metadata. The activity records that allow them both the big picture, ability to analyze data at scale, and the little picture, ability to make perfect maps, chronologies, and associative synopses of an individual's personal life, from which they presume to extrapolate predictions of behavior. In sum, metadata can tell your surveillant virtually everything they'd ever want or need to know about you, except what's actually going on inside your head. After reading this classified report, I spent the next weeks, even months, in a daze. I was sad and low, trying to deny everything I was thinking and feeling. That's what was going on in my head toward the end of my stint in Japan. I felt far from home, but monitored. I felt more adult than ever, but also cursed with the knowledge that all of us had been reduced to something like children, who'd be forced to live the rest of our lives under omniscient parental supervision. I felt like a fraud, making excuses to Lindsay to explain my sullenness. I felt like a fool, as someone of supposedly serious technical skills, who'd somehow helped to build an essential component of this system without realizing its purpose. I felt used as an employee of the IC who only now was realizing that all along I'd been protecting not my country, but the state. I felt, above all, violated. Being in Japan only accentuated this sense of betrayal. I'll explain. The Japanese that I'd managed to pick up through community college and my interest in anime and manga was enough for me to speak and get through basic conversations, but reading was a different matter. In Japanese, each word can be represented by its own unique character, or a combination of characters called kanji. So there were tens of thousands of them, far too many for me to memorize. Often, I was only able to decode particular kanji if they were written with their phonetic gloss, the furigana, which are most commonly meant for foreigners and young readers, and so are typically absent from public texts like street signs. The result of this was that I walked around functionally illiterate. I'd get confused and end up going right when I should have gone left, or left when I should have gone right. I'd wander down the wrong streets and misorder from menus. I was a stranger, is what I'm saying, and often lost in more ways than one. There were times when I'd accompany Lindsay out on one of her photography trips into the countryside, and I'd suddenly stop and realize, in the midst of a village or in the middle of a forest, that I knew nothing whatsoever about my surroundings. And yet, everything was known about me. Now I understood that I was totally transparent to my government. The phone that gave me directions and corrected me when I went the wrong way and helped me translate the traffic signs and told me the times of the buses and trains was also making sure that all of my doings were legible to my employers. It was telling my bosses where I was and when, even if I never touched the thing and just left it in my pocket. I remember forcing myself to laugh about this once when Lindsay and I got lost on a hike, and Lindsay, to whom I'd told nothing, just spontaneously said, "Well, why don't you text Fort Meade and have them find us?" She kept the joke going, and I tried to find it funny, but couldn't. "Hello," she mimicked me. "Can you help us with directions?" Later, I would live in Hawaii, near Pearl Harbor, where America was attacked and dragged into what might have been its last just war. Here in Japan, I was closer to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where that war ignominiously ended. Lindsay and I had always hoped to visit those cities, but every time we planned to go, we wound up having to cancel. On one of my first days off, we were all set to head down Honshu to Hiroshima, but I was called into work and told to go in the opposite direction, to Misawa Air Base in the frozen north. On the day of our next scheduled attempt, Lindsay got sick, and then I got sick too. Finally, the night before we intended to go to Nagasaki, Lindsay and I were woken by our first major earthquake, jumped up from our futon, ran down 7 flights of stairs, and spent the rest of the night out on the street with our neighbors, shivering in our pajamas. To my true regret, we never went. Those places are holy places, whose memorials honor the 200,000 incinerated and the countless poisoned by fallout, while reminding us of technology's amorality. I think often of what's called the atomic moment, a phrase that in physics describes the moment when a nucleus coheres the protons and neutrons spinning around it into an atom. But that's popularly understood to mean the advent of the nuclear age, whose isotopes enabled advances in energy production, agriculture, water potability, and the diagnosis and treatment of deadly disease. It also created the atomic bomb. Technology doesn't have a Hippocratic oath. So many decisions that have been made by technologists in academia, industry, the military, and government since at least the Industrial Revolution have been made on the basis of can we, not should we. And the intention driving a technology's invention rarely, if ever, limits its application and use. I do not mean, of course, to compare nuclear weapons with cyber surveillance in terms of human cost. But there is a commonality when it comes to the concepts of proliferation and disarmament. The only two countries I knew of that had previously practiced mass surveillance were those two other major combatants of World War II. One, America's enemy, the other, America's ally. In both Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia, the earliest public indications of that surveillance took the superficially innocuous form of a census, the official enumeration and statistical recording of a population. The first all-union census of the Soviet Union in 1926 had a secondary agenda beyond a simple count. It overtly queried Soviet citizens about their nationality. Its findings convinced the ethnic Russians who comprised the Soviet elite that they were in the minority when compared to the aggregated masses of citizens who claimed a Central Asian heritage, such as Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Tajiks, Turkmen, Georgians, and Armenians. These findings significantly strengthened Stalin's resolve to eradicate these cultures by re-educating their populations in the deracinating ideology of Marxism-Leninism. The Nazi German census of 1933 took on a similar statistical project, but with the assistance of computer technology. It set out to count the Reich's population in order to control it and to purge it, mainly of Jews and Roma, before exerting its murderous efforts on populations beyond its borders. To effect this, the Reich partnered with Dehomag, a German subsidiary of the American IBM, which owned the patent to the punch card tabulator, a sort of analog computer that counted holes punched into cards. Each citizen was represented by a card, and certain holes on the cards represented certain markers of identity. Column 22 addressed the religion rubric. Hole 1 was Protestant, hole 2 Catholic, and hole 3 Jewish. In 1933, the Nazis still officially regarded Jews not as a race, but as a religion. That view was dropped a few years later, by which time this census information was being used to identify and deport Europe's Jewish population to the death camps. A single current model smartphone commands more computing power than all of the wartime machinery of the Reich and the Soviet Union combined. Recalling this is the surest way to contextualize not just the modern American IC's technological dominance, but also the threat it poses to democratic governance. In the century or so since those census efforts, technology has made astounding progress, but the same could not be said for the law or human scruples that could restrain it. The United States has a census too, of course. The Constitution established the American Census and enshrined it as the official federal count of each state's population in order to determine its proportional delegation to the House of Representatives. That was something of a revisionist principle, in that authoritarian governments, including the British monarchy that ruled the colonies, had traditionally used the census as a method of assessing taxes and ascertaining the number of young men eligible for military conscription. It was the Constitution's genius to repurpose what had been a mechanism of oppression into one of democracy. The census, which is officially under the jurisdiction of the Senate, was ordered to be performed every 10 years, which was roughly the amount of time it took to process the data of most American censuses following the first census of 1790. This decade-long lag was shortened by the census of 1890, which was the world's first census to make use of computers, the prototypes of the models that IBM later sold to Nazi Germany. With computing technology, the process time was cut in half. Digital technology didn't just further streamline such accounting, it is rendering it obsolete. Mass surveillance is now a never-ending census, substantially more dangerous than any questionnaire sent through the mail. All our devices, from our phones to our computers, are basically miniature census takers we carry in our backpacks and in our pockets. Census takers that remember everything and forgive nothing. Japan was my atomic moment. It was then that I realized where these new technologies were headed, and that if my generation didn't intervene, the escalation would only continue. It would be a tragedy if, by the time we'd finally resolved to resist, such resistance were futile. The generations to come would have to get used to a world in which surveillance wasn't something occasional and directed in legally justified circumstances, but a constant and indiscriminate presence. The ear that always hears, the eye that always sees, a memory that is sleepless and permanent. Once the ubiquity of collection was combined with the permanency of storage, all any government had to do was select a person or a group to scapegoat and go searching, as I'd gone searching through the agency's files, for evidence of a suitable crime.